that would already resolve half of our problems. It would help us to continue other fights, like work and against discrimination. The requisition law exists. It has to be applied.
I don't have a house. I'm moving from here to there. Once they proposed me a studio with toilets and a bathroom outside, I was disappointed. Now it's been more than 3 years I'm demonstrating with this association, Right to Housing, because they do the right thing.
This building in the center of Paris is entirely empty. This building in the rich 8th district of Paris is also entirely empty. Same for this huge building in the Boulevard Haussmann, another rich area in Paris. The owners are often big insurance or real estate companies, and the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. That's called speculation.
We have a law of acquisition of empty buildings, housings, and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of acquisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or are poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. The solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Denant, Paris.
Afghans are yet to wait for the rise of peace in their war-ravaged country, as the ongoing war in Afghanistan continues to claim the lives of large numbers of civilians, including women and children, on a daily basis. According to rights bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 30,000 civilians were killed and more than 60,000 others, including women and children, injured in the Afghan war over the past 11 years. All conflicting sides, including terrorist groups, US-led NATO troops and pro-government forces, are being blamed for these casualties. However, some international bodies like the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, and other independent bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, name chiefly terrorist groups accountable for much of these casualties. They also call on the Afghan government to bring the killers of Afghan people into justice via any possible legal attempt.
Unfortunately, nearly 100,000 civilians, including women and children, have fallen victim to the war in Afghanistan over the past 11 years. We call on the government to share its findings about these deaths and bring the accountable figures to justice.
This comes as experts believe there would be no zero civilian casualties unless the Taliban militant group changes its mind and accepts a new Afghanistan that differs from what it was before 2001.
Approval of a ceasefire by Taliban is highly important. They must realize that remaining indifferent to the suffering of people will have dire consequences.
Violence has been rising in Afghanistan amid intra-Afghan talks in Doha and US troops withdrawal. Afghanistan remains in the 11 most dangerous nations list for children, according to Save the Children. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross reported last month that Afghanistan remains the deadliest country for civilians. Half of the civilian fatalities include Afghan women and children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested Eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute, but ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. When the heads of state of 14 nations sat down together in late 2018 to discuss the grim condition of the world's oceans, there was no certainty that anything consequential would result. The leaders planned 14 gatherings, but met only twice before the pandemic upended their talks. So when the group announced recently the world's most far-reaching pact to protect and sustain ocean health, it signaled a bit more than a noteworthy achievement in a complicated time. The agreement negotiated by the nuance-free tool of video conferencing also offered hope of a renewed era of global accord on climate, where issues grounded in science might finally trump political posturing. Stay with us for an article written by Laura Parker, an expert in climate change and marine environment. The piece is titled, In Rare Show of Solidarity, 14 Key Nations Commit to Protect Oceans. Overall, the 14 leaders agreed to sustainably manage 100% of the oceans under their national jurisdictions by 2025, an area of ocean roughly the size of Africa. Additionally, they vowed to set aside 30% of the seas as marine protected areas by 2030, in keeping with the United Nations campaign known as 30 by 30. Both of those large commitments, the leader said, will help end overfishing and illegal fishing, rebuild declining fish stocks, halt the flow of plastic waste into the seas, and clean up dead zones created by runoff from the farm waste. Nancy Knowlton, a marine scientist emeritus at the Smithsonian Institution, who was not involved in the project, says, What I find really interesting is that 14 nations spent the last 2 years talking to each other in an experiment you'd like to see more of in the future. They are working together as a team, starting with countries on the same page provides the mechanism for actually achieving success. The 14 members are Australia, Canada, Chile, Ghana, Indonesia, Japan, Kenya, Mexico, Namibia, Norway, Portugal, and the island nations of Fiji, Jamaica, and Palau. Combined, they represent 40% of the world's coastlines, 30% of the offshore exclusive economic zones, 20% of the world's fisheries, and 20% of the world's shipping fleet. Vidar Helgesen, Norway's former Minister of Climate and Environment and a driving force behind the project, says negotiations with that category of country isn't all that easy. We decided to get a group where high politics wouldn't get in the way and we could be focused on the task. The idea, Vidar Helgesen says, was to gather a coalition of the willing, a like-minded group of countries with the ocean deeply embedded in their culture and history, to conduct discussions that would be underpinned by science. Consequently, the high-level panel for a sustainable ocean economy includes nations large and small, rich and poor, spread across all ocean basins. All are economically dependent to various degrees on the seas and oceans. The 14 leaders are now inviting other nations to join the effort. It was backed up by a team of 253 scientists that conducted new ocean research and published 16 authoritative papers on topics ranging from an assessment of stemming the flow of plastic waste to combating climate change. The members of the high-level panel also were willing to turn conventional thinking on its ear. Instead of considering the ocean as merely a victim of climate change, which it undoubtedly is, at its both warming and acidifying, the leaders say the seas should be harnessed to become part of the global solution. The key to that is to take an all-in approach, sustainably managing 100% of the oceans, not just the protected areas. Properly managed, the panel says, the ocean economy, including fishing, can expand. Additionally, actions such as restoration of mangroves, kelp beds, and seagrasses that absorb carbon could help offset global emissions by as much as a fifth and help hold global warming to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.5 degrees Celsius, the leaders say. Jane Lubchenco, who co-chaired the high-level panel's expert committee, says, "We have acted as if we had to choose between protecting the ocean or using it. That's a false choice. We're discovering smarter ways to use the ocean without using it up. The secret lies in protecting the health of the ocean ecosystems." She says the solutions offered by the panel could generate 40 times more renewable energy through development of offshore wind energy production and wave and tidal power, and lift millions of people out of poverty. The panel's economists forecast that every $1 spent invested in a sustainable ocean would return $5 in economic, social, and environmental benefits. The solutions involve a range of 74 actions, some already in progress. New technologies, for example, enabled Ghana to track foreign fishing vessels lurking off its coast and crack down on illegal fishing, while the panel's call for investment in sewage and waste management infrastructure to curb the flow of plastic waste into the seas is prohibitively expensive and unlikely to happen on a large scale in the coming decades. Many developing nations have banned various single-use plastic products, and others are deploying catchment systems on major rivers in Thailand, for example, also in Vietnam and Indonesia, to capture plastic waste before it is disgorged into the seas. We'll be right back. 50-50 approach sounds to some like just another blue ribbon exercise in futility, the leaders say the time for small steps has passed. The ocean, which covers 70% of the globe and produces more than half of the oxygen on Earth, has reached such a dire point of decline that more drastic action is needed now. The world's decade-long inability to rebuild dwindling fish stocks to feed a growing world population offers a timeline that strikingly illustrates the point. Fishing reached peak catch in the mid-1990s, marking the beginning of a long decline. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned in a special 2019 report on fragile ocean health that without action, fish could decrease by 25% by 2100. Henrik Sala, a marine scientist and National Geographic explorer in residence, says, "No way is applying more effort to fishing going to get us more fish. Likewise, setting aside small slivers of ocean for protection, just 7% of the seas are designated marine protected areas, will not restore ocean health. Even 30% is not considered enough." At the same time, the phrase sustainably managed is such a broad, elusive term that it opens the door wide for skepticism. Daniel Pawley, a world-renowned fisheries expert at the University of British Columbia in Canada, who was not associated with the project, praised the effort, but he remains dubious of the notion that the term sustainably managed has any meaningful impact. Daniel Pawley says most of the public doesn't know that sustainable doesn't mean abundant. "You can sustain any level, including low levels. You can sustain a stock that is overfished." On the other hand, less skeptics dismiss the idea that just 14 of the world's 192 coastal nations could make an impact. Consider that Japan, a powerful influence in the Asia-Pacific, signed onto the agreement to set aside 30% of the oceans in marine protected areas. The fact that Japan, which has long signaled reluctance to create protected areas, has changed course is a big deal, according to Sala. Now, when the United Nations meets next year in China to continue work on a global marine protection treaty that still eludes adoption, having Japan on board in support of marine protected areas may ease the way for other nations to reconsider.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
Regarding the U.S., our policy has been a calculated and transparent policy, one that will not change with the arrival of different individuals. Today is the U.S. presidential elections. Some people keep talking about who should and should not come. They speak about the consequences of each candidate winning. Well, certain things might happen, but they will not be of any concern to us as they will not influence our policy in any way, because our policy is a calculated and transparent policy, one that will not be affected with the arrival of individuals. However, if you look at their own condition, you will find them in a spectacular condition. The president who currently holds office and who is organizing the election says that this is one of the most fraudulent elections in U.S. history. Who says this? This is being claimed by a person who is president himself and who is actually holding and administering the elections.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The other candidate says in return that Trump intends to rig the elections on a large scale. This is American democracy. They themselves are saying these things about their elections. This is an example of the uglier reality of liberal democracy inside the U.S. Well, no matter which one will be elected, it will become clear which one will be the winner. There is a completely clear point, which is the political, civil and moral decline of the American regime. This will not change with the arrival of either of them. The American regime is truly and severely suffering from a political, civil and moral decline, and this is not mere analysis. What I am saying here is not merely an analysis, rather, this is being acknowledged by themselves.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, more than a month since the U.S. presidential election, and clashes are still taking place between Trump supporters and those against him. Trump and much of the Republican Party, as well as many of his supporters, continue to say that the election was fraudulent. With emotions running high, clashes have taken place in several cities in the U.S., with several people being taken to the hospital. Where is this going? And with this country so greatly divided, could either a Biden presidency or a Trump presidency be able to bring this country together again? Well, I'm going to start this off with crossing over to Washington, D.C., talking to correspondent Wyatt Reed. Wyatt, thanks so much for being with us. Wyatt, you actually been covering the situation and also the demonstrations that took place yesterday. Tell us about the overall emotional aspect of it, because temperatures seem to be running as high as prior to the election.
Yes, it was quite an eventful day. Tempers really flaring yesterday. We saw thousands of pro-Trump demonstrators who took again to the streets. This is sort of a follow-up to last month's Stop the Steal rally. We saw much of the same dynamics playing out. What was notable was that the Proud Boys seemed to have a stronger presence. The Proud Boys, of course, frequently described as a neo-fascist group. They were infamously told by President Donald Trump to stand back and stand by in a September presidential debate. They spent much of the day inciting violence against anyone who they sort of perceived to be their ideological opponents, that would be anti-fascists or Black Lives Matter protesters, before spending the evening essentially on the hunt for any kind of Black Lives Matter banisters. There are a number of them displayed prominently throughout the Washington, D.C. Area, and they were stealing these signs, vandalizing them, returning them. One in particular was a Black Lives Matter sign that they stole from the Ashbury United Methodist Church, which is the city's oldest Black Methodist church, and then they promptly burned that, leading many local activists and observers to point out sort of the historic connections between this kind of group and between the racial intimidation that has long characterized the far right in this country.
To jump in here, but what about police presence and the reaction of police on the scene there?
Police presence was somehow, to many observers, both overdoing it and somehow underdoing it, a little bit too much and not enough at the same time. Cops had a strong presence throughout much of the day. They were blocking off Black Lives Matter Plaza from anyone entering for much of the day. Hundreds and hundreds of police deployed for sure, but it seemed that when it counted, that is to say when the far-right formations were attempting to sort of go out and instigate any kind of violence, the police were nowhere to be found. We've seen dozens of videos on social media of the numerous fights instigated by, generally speaking, by the right-wing forces, and the police were not anywhere to be found in many of these videos. Of course, they did arrest somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 people, and they're not saying specifically whether those people were pro-Trump, anti-Trump, Antifa, Proud Boys. None of that information has been forthcoming so far, but the police presence, to many on the ground, left quite a bit to be desired.
All right, thanks so much for being with us, Wyatt Reed, correspondent in D.C. I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of New York, journalist and radio host Don DeBar. Don, great to see you.
Hi, Marcy. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
It's been a while since we've talked, Don. Yeah. But, Don, when we look at the situation and what's going on, I mean, these demonstrations are taking place 5 weeks after many Americans believe that Biden was announced the winner of the election and president-elect. Your perspective, why are we still seeing such violent clashes to take place?
I'm not in D.C. today or this weekend.
I'm speaking with people there regularly over the last couple of days, and I've been watching the marches that have been taking place on various internet news carriers. I can't use the most appropriate term for this, but the television-friendly version would be, it's like a doo-doo burlesque that we're seeing. There's, we always know this, the apparent and material of, what you see and what is. And here we have a context of these two sides that have, these are the ones that are advocating for one of the other candidates in the election, blue, red hat, of that dichotomy. They've been agitated to the point now for 4 years and change into believing that the other an existential threat to them, that one hand, Trump represents Hitler, fascism, all of that, and they're looking to take away your liberties, freedom, and put you in Google or something. On the other side, they're communists, they're with the Chinese, they're crazy left-wing radical maniacs, and they're looking to take away your property, put you in the Gulag. That's the mindset of a lot of people that are on the street right now on either side of this. Now, the margins you see this weekend, the official marches were Trump support, Trump campaign oriented, retail politics kind of demonstrations. They were not Proud Boys or anything else. The Proud Boys, for example, are an insignificant portion of the people that were marching this weekend in Washington. Antifa, for all of the press that this gets, also is really not representative of the opposite side of Biden supporters. And so we're watching a wrestling match on a television that's supposed to represent power struggle. Mm-hmm. Because you also have behind Biden and Trump a real power struggle among the elite in the United States over a number of really important issues, including the most important one, war and peace.
Okay, Don, stay with me. Stay with me. I'm definitely going to pick up and continue with you on that line that you just brought up. But let me introduce and get in our next guest to the program, Jack Rice, lawyer and media analyst out of Minneapolis. Jack, thanks so much for being with us. Sam, what do you think? Do you think that Biden has actually been officially claimed the winner? Or does this really have to wait until the Electoral College members meet? Is this over yet, or is there still a possibility that the results will be turned around?
Well, I guess it just depends upon whom you ask, right? Yeah. If we look at where we are right now, there have been more than 36 lawsuits that have been filed by the Trump administration or by the Trump team in this case, including the latest by the U.S. Supreme Court that was before the U.S. Supreme Court. That was simply turned back by saying, you have no justification to even be in this courtroom right now because you're not one of the parties. But if you can think about one of these that just happened yesterday in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and also another, a federal court in Wisconsin, where they said the Trump team wants us to apply the rule of law. We have. Understand, that was a Republican who was on the bench. This was a Trump person who was put on the bench by Trump. And in fact, that is something that is absolutely scorching. This has happened again and again and again. We have never seen anything quite like this in the United States. And so I think about this as a trial lawyer, watching what it is that the courts are doing at the district court levels in places like Georgia, in places like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, Arizona. The list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he's getting beaten in this way. And the question now will be, does he stop? He says he won't. But the problem is that from a legal standpoint, he has very few places to go.
Well, Jack, staying with you, I mean, and you, we talk about the various lawsuits that have been thrown out. What's your take on it all? Is it because with the claims of fraud, of course, that he has said, is it that he's losing these cases? Are basically the lawsuits are being thrown out because there has been no proof of fraud, or is it because of a cover-up, as Trump and his supporters claim?
You know, if you take a look at the people who are hearing these claims, many of whom are conservatives, Republicans, if you will, who are on the bench, who are judges in these cases. And they have looked at not only factual questions, because that has been a big part of this, but also legal decisions, looking at standing, looking at issues like that. These are not exceptions. These aren't little things. In fact, what we have heard in Pennsylvania was, in fact, there were no claims of fraud. What you've seen from the likes of Giuliani and some of his team is that they would go out into the press, and what they would do is they would spin extraordinary claims. And then when they would get in front of a judge, they would get ripped to pieces, and you would find that they couldn't even make the claims themselves. Now, understand, not just am I a former prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer, I teach trial advocacy worldwide, across the United States, and I watched what Giuliani was doing, what Giuliani was saying inside of courtrooms. When you read the transcripts, it was horrific how pitiful the arguments were worded. And I'm just saying this from a legal standpoint. They were absolutely beaten at every single stage, and they had nothing that they could use that would stick. And that's just fact.
Okay. Well, Don, I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about what we're seeing in reality is this clash of the elite. I want you to expand on that, please. What do you mean?
Yeah, very briefly touch on what we just heard. It's not true. In the US, first of all, as a trial lawyer, the other guy's understands that you don't score this like a bowling match. It's not 38 cases to 2 or whatever that decides prevails. In one case, you win. It's the right case. So, and most of the cases that have been decided so far were decided not on the merit of the arguments or of the claims, but rather over what he called legal issues, but technical issues, like the wrong party brought the lawsuit, which happened at the Supreme Court. There are viable cases pending, any one of which, any couple of which, could produce an outcome that could reverse the election. In addition to that, there are political processes involved going on, starting with the Electoral College tomorrow and go to the joint session on January 6th, where a different outcome could also come out. Speculating as to how likely that is, that's a fool's errand, really. We don't know. This is uncharted territory. As far as it goes with the behind-the-scenes game, and that's the part that makes it uncharted territory, you have had evidence in the United States before the world for the last 4 years, essentially the elite on one side, with the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, most of the institutional power, the corporate and foundation media in the United States, a good part of the Republican Party political establishment, Mitt Romney and, down the list, McCain, et cetera, all hostile to the President of the United States, and the claim, the public narrative that this was over is the relationship between Trump and Russia, and the claim that the United States is not standing up to Russia because he's a puppet of the Russian government. Now, what that said, is if the side that wants him out over that really means it and they prevail, then we could be looking potentially at a war with Russia. And if you look at the condition of relations when Trump took office, the United States was having war games at a regular basis on Russia's borders from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula. To me, that's the real game that's afoot here, and the rest of it is a TV show that we're looking at.
All right. Well, now, Jack, Don had talked about the Supreme Court and refusing to hear the complaint of fraudulent elections by Trump. In the state of Texas, now the head of the Republican Party in Texas, Alan West, has said that the state should consider seceding and forming another union with other states. Your take on his comments and the effect of these comments at this point in time?
Yeah, I would say he's simply pandering. I mean, he's pandering to the extreme part of his party. And honestly, I think it's treasonous. I truly do. I think that anybody who is an elected official in this case is actually talking about breaking up the United States of America is treasonous. A big part of what we see here is that it's not just about one person in one place. We have 126 members of the House of Representatives. That is a majority of the Republicans in the House of Representatives right now who are actually coming together. And yet, This was based upon this argument that was made in Texas. Now remember, I mean, this is a big part of what people sometimes forget, is that this is not so much a national election as it is basically 50 state elections. And the problem that they had in this case was that Texas was arguing that these other states didn't do their elections right. Well, the whole concept of federalism, the idea in the United States that is that each state themselves has the right, the literal right, to protect and to apply the laws as they see fit to their states themselves. The idea that Texas would say, we don't like what Georgia did, is almost anti-federalism. And understand, the strongest advocates for federalism in the United States were the conservatives themselves. So I've kind of been scratching my head watching this, and then you have more than half of the conservatives supporting it. Again, I'm completely amazed by this. Clearly the answer is they don't like the outcome. They don't like how it played out, so therefore they're going to fight every single fight.
Don, go ahead. You want to say something, Don? Go ahead.
Yeah, not only does each state have control of their process in selecting a president, but pursuant to the Constitution, of course, which is the state legislature under Article 1, Section 2, was it 2-1? Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, the state legislature has to do it. They also have an expectation and a right, as basically this mutual consideration for entering into this agreement, that they expect this from each of the other states as well. And so they shouldn't be powerless to watch illegal processes go on in the other states where the state legislature should have been conducting, or the laws of that state were clearly violated, blatantly violated, that they have to live with the outcome, which alters their rights. In other words, if I'm playing by the rules and you're not, what game are we playing? That's what the question is going on. And that lawsuit, by the way, it was decided on the question of standing, that the states couldn't bring the action, but rather the aggrieved parties being Trump or the electors of those states would be the ones who would have a stake in the argument I just presented.
But that's the problem.
Go ahead, Jack.
That's the problem, because what you ultimately have in a case like this is that the Supreme Court came down and said the state can't do this, and you still have half the Republicans on the Federalist side actually arguing that they should. Remember, out of nine Supreme Court justices, we had a majority who are conservatives. All three of Trump's appointees all came in together and said, you can't do this. The fact that you saw 17 attorneys general who were Republicans, 126 Republicans in the House of Representatives, all coming together, when in fact, the Supremes essentially completely, all nine, really seven, but not seven plus two, all came together and said, you can't. It's just astounding, because these very same people would never have argued this point before Trump lost, because that's not philosophically what we have seen. Not when somebody says, if I'm from Texas, nobody gets to tell me how Texas runs, certainly not Georgia, certainly not Pennsylvania. So it is astounding. I think we can agree on that.
You're a law professor. I don't want to argue the law with you unless we're in your classroom, which I enjoy doing that, like a lot of people do with different professors.
Well, go ahead,
the case is going back to court. In the germane part of the case is going back to court. It'll probably be Trump and some of the electors in either the aggrieved states or the subject states that'll be joining in, the Republicans, say, in Pennsylvania or whatever, Republican electors. And it's going to start at the district court level, and it's going to wind its way through to wherever.
So Don, let me just jump in here, because we have limited time. So basically, are you saying there's still a chance that this could be overthrown? And one other question, do you believe that the election was fraudulent?
From the beginning. I mean, well, first of all, just about every election in the United States is fraudulent in one fashion or another. The structure itself, what was designed almost, including the Electoral College, as a constraint on democratic rule as opposed to something to facilitate. The people that constructed this were property owners, including owning human property, and they wanted to protect their property rights above all else. And that is sort of in the DNA of the law here. So that about all of the presidential elections, but in this particular case, there's a unique constellation here of forces. that is essentially the entrenched forces, the neocons and the neoliberals who have been in charge of policy in the United States and pretty much the world since 1991 anyway, but in the United States since the 1980s, and others who represent, first of all, represent a look towards multipolarity in international relations as opposed to the hegemony, and secondly, again, on the question of war and peace with Russia and also with China, two divergent points of view that are apparently very strongly held. If you look at the effort and time and just the wordage put into the Russiagate narrative from before the election until about 3 weeks ago.
Jack, what now? Where do you see this going? We're looking at a very, very divided country, and regardless which individual becomes the next president, we're talking about individuals who've gotten the most votes ever of anyone ever running for president in the United States. So we're talking about many people, at least 75 million on each side here who voted, who are still very adamant about their candidate and very strong emotions about the other candidate. Your take on prognosis and can whoever's president bring the country together?
We have never seen our system stress tested in the way that we have during this election. And I will acknowledge over the last 4 years, it's been pretty brutal as well. But if we look at this election, we've never seen anything like this. There's going to be midterms coming up in 2 years. And what we find is that if the conservatives come out or whoever comes out and they decide they want a different person to be in the House, a different person to be in the Senate, then they should vote their choice. I think what's been incredibly disturbing, particularly about this election, is that this president has never had a problem with going after the Department of Defense, the Secretary of State, the Defense Department, the State Department, the intelligence community, or just about anybody else, and been willing to burn him to the ground in order to do so for his own benefit.
Okay, stay with me, Jack. I only have 30 seconds. Don, your take. Yeah, where do you see this going?
Very divided country. Also, really low confidence in the institutions. That's been, you know, building for decades, but certainly in the last 8 years or so, that's been accelerating. So really a dangerous look ahead. And as far as it goes, if Trump saw the CIA, FBI, et cetera, as enemies, that relates with a lot of people in the United States. And not all maniac right-wingers either. I'm a lefty. I've been a communist my whole adult life. So I don't it's not it. Those are actually dangerous institutions. And to have an advocate in the White House for our position for a change, it's quite a remarkable thing, actually.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us for an interesting conversation. Don DeBar, journalist.